Good evening, you guys. I'm K2, Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet. There are three guys who run the TechNet. Dick, John, and Paul. And we're also some help from Hal. Dick is K2RIW. John is KC2WGB. He handles the mailbag, among other things. Paul's WS2N gives us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. Hal, from time to time, will give us a more brief answer to my more verbose answer. The main thing the TechNet is a vehicle for education. It gathers people from the tri-state New York City area, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, most of Long Island, western Connecticut, a lot of brain power in that area. And so from time to time, hams, particularly hams that are new to the hobby, will have a question about transmitters, receivers, antennas, propagation, transmission lines, all of this RF hardware. How does it work? How to make it work better? How to get more enjoyment out of the hobby? So if you're curious, you want to know something more, you've come to the right place. Let me drop. So the main purpose of the TechNet, as I said, is education. For the first hour, we discuss usually not too deep, but mostly pure ham radio questions. Occasionally, we go a little bit off of that. A person who's curious is curious about many things, and from time to time, that curiosity will lead to serendipity. So if he makes discoveries he never expected to make because of that curiosity. So we don't discourage that. At roughly 9 o'clock, 9:15, somewhere in that area, John starts reading us mailbag submittals. In other words, people who don't yet have their ham license, they're on the process of getting one, or don't have the equipment yet where they can talk to us live. They send him emails, snail mails, and so on with their questions. And sometimes we get some really deep questions there. Some of those guys, I suspect, are working on their master's thesis, if you know what I mean. That's followed by Paul telling us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And of course, I have to always ask him, what is the distance to Voyager these days? I think it's 128 astronomical units, something like 8 billion miles, and increasing at some ridiculously high rate. It's the most long-range piece of hardware that mankind has ever created. It's breaking all kinds of records, and you ain't heard nothing yet as it leaves the solar system and enters intergalactic space. That thing is one hell of a Voyager, which is its name. After that, after those portions of the menu, we then go into deeper subjects where almost anything is allowed, if you know what I mean. A person signs into the TechNet by giving those three or four guys your call letters, your name. You have to give me your name because I'm not forgetful. Followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1516 of the series that began.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was saying, of the series that began way back in 1982, roughly 32 years ago. So after 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed to us anymore. We don't spend the time with long lists of people signing in because they're listening. We assume there are listeners by way of IRLP and Echolink. We quite often get questions from people quite far away, other states, occasionally other countries. So we welcome those. We have to try to remember that in between our transmissions, we leave enough space. There's four beeps you're supposed to wait for, and maybe 1 or 2 seconds beyond that, we should be using periodically. And maybe once every 5 minutes or so, we should let the machine drop completely to dead noise to make sure everything is reset, so the guys that are very far out of the area get a chance to sign in. Also, John lately has been monitoring the Echolink and IRLP so that if you're out there and not able to sign in, and you're trying to, John will know about it, particularly if you send him a message of letting him know about that. Let me pass it over to you, John. What is the mechanism by which they send you a message? And does Echolink or IRLP have that directly? Will you know it because the guy made an attempt that wasn't successful? Or must he actually send you some form of message? KC2WGB, our Echolink monitor, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick. KC2WGB. Yes, I'm monitoring Echolink, not IRLP. and the chat room too. I can see who is on Echolink, this list, all the call signs, and if the question is typed into the lower pad, I can see that question if they have something to ask, or if they need attention, I can bring it to your attention that they're requesting that. So I can do that automatically, also through the chat room. So either one of those, but not IRLP, that I don't monitor. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
He doesn't monitor IRLP yet. He's only got two computers side by side. He's monitoring now. If we get him a third computer, and Eric supplies him with the right computer program, maybe he can monitor that also. And with his third hand, he'll be typing on that particular keyboard. I'm having some fun with John here. Okay, so we're ready now for people who really do have questions or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name with the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, BE3ZTZ, Scott, and yes. And he's one of the guys from the Golden Horseshoe area of Canada who quite often signs in. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike, Papa, Joe, requesting to make an educational announcement.
Okay, Joe recognized. And as soon as we get the rest of the list, we'll go over to Joe. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Give me a call letters right now.
N2EO, Dick, November 2, Echo Oscar, Rich with a question for the net.
You got Rich? Anyone else?
82 ESW, Tom with a question for the net.
Okay, Tom, your audio is a little bit low. It sounds like you said Kilo Delta 2. Echo Sierra Tango. Did I get that correct, Tom? Go ahead.
No, negative. Echo Sierra Whiskey.
Hey, Echo Sierra Whiskey. We got you, Tom. Anyone else assigning? Give me your call letters right now.
Kilo 1, Mike Julia Mike. Name is Mike. Yes.
Okay. That's Mike number 2, I call him. The two Mikes you guys should know about. Mike number 1 is Mike from New Jersey. K2NJI, I think it is. And he has the website called www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and the last 7 years, or is it 7.5 years, of TechNet are all essentially recorded, with a couple of exceptions. And so you can play them all back. Mike number 2, K1MJM from Connecticut, has this beautiful website that when you go there, that website is limarktechnet.com. If I got it correct, limarktechnet.com. Mike, can correct me on that one. And there you'll see quite a bit of information that goes along with this particular TechNet. Pictures of antennas and people and past articles and whatever that are helpful. Did I have that website correct, Mike? Let me pass it over to you to make sure you correct me. K1MJM, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Roger, Dick, that's right. Kilo 1, Mike Julia, Mike, this is. Yeah, it's LimarkTechNet.com, that's right.
Okay, sometimes I get the .coms and the .nets mixed up. One of my other favorites is Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.com. If you're at all interested in microwave, you should start off with that particular website. Just look at his page. At the bottom of that page, he's got the information about how to get the ideal impedance match to any dipole, no matter where it's located, near the ground, up in the air, part of a Yagi, whatever. How to get a perfect impedance match. You'd be amazed how important that is. Okay, so far we've got Joe with some information. Questions so far from Rich, Tom, and Mike. Anyone else with signing in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
I'm Paul with the space report. Well, you know I'm here, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. I knew you were there. On the input, a man I'm hearing that didn't come through the machine, Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha something. Give me those call letters again. Make sure your PL is turned on because you're not coming through the machine at this time. The Alpha Charlie 2, go right ahead. Yeah, that's Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu, Bob from Huntington, one of the former members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, an astronomer from way back. He's also the guy you want to talk to if you're into low light cameras, and we're going to have some conversations with Bob later on. Okay, Bob has signed in. Okay, let's go over to Joe. I know you've got an educational announcement. Whiskey 2, Baker Mike Papa. K2RID. You go ahead, Joe.
Thank you very much, Dick. I'd just like to remind everybody that we'll be sponsoring our web-based, instructor-led technical class starting on September 2nd. We have 5 seats available for this virtual class, 100% on the web, and instructor-led. If anybody's interested or knows somebody who needs to get their technical license, all they need to do is email me, education@limark.org. Once again, that's education@limark.org. Thank you for the break, Nick. Have a good evening.
Okay, glad to hear that, Joe. education@limark.org. And if you do go to limark.org webpage, boy, you'll find a lot of stuff. My only complaint is that there's a darn much stuff there. You better know what you want ahead of time.
Quick question, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, did we have to pick up a further subject with Joe RYY? Was that scheduled for this week? I didn't hear him check in.
If you remember last week, Joe was afraid that by the time we got to him, it would be past his bedtime because he's got to get up at 3:30 in the morning. So we did take him early last week. And I think we finished his question, but if not, I'll give a little bit of a standby and see if Joe has any further question on the subject we discussed with him last week. To be 2RYY, if you want to say something, keep 2RYW in the TechNet.
Maybe not. You need to actually answer the question this week? I asked you a question last week. I can ask another one this week too, Dick.
Okay. What John was concerned about, Joe, was whether or not your question, which we sort of squeezed you in a hurry last week, did we get a chance to finish last week's question? That was what John was worried about. From your point of view, was last week's question sufficiently covered that you could go out now and use that information and earn a whole lot of money? To be 2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Are we listening
to
our
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one. I'll tell you what. Here's a question you can put in with your space report stuff, because it fits right in. And I've also wondered about this myself. Now that Voyager is like the moment number, billion miles out there, way, way out there, what system on that apparatus is used to keep it aimed at Earth, and what function system will that ever run out of fuel so it can't readjust itself over time as time goes on? There you go. You can digest that one for a while.
Very fine, Joe. I've got 100% copy on you, but your signal through the repeater was extremely noisy, roughly 50% or 80% noise, 20% audio. But Joe is asking the question about the Voyager out there at 8 billion miles, 128 astronomical units. When Paul comes back later on from the space report. And what Joe's going to be doing is listening with his loudspeaker under the pillow while he's going to sleep during the space report. And Paul's going to be telling us the answer to Joe's question of how in the world, with that half-degree beam-width antenna that has to be aimed at the Earth with 8.5 gigahertz signal, how in the world does Voyager make sure that that antenna is aimed in the right spot? And its reaction control gas and its reaction wheels and whatever, when is that going to run down so it loses the ability? I know that Paul has told us that Voyager most likely will be still communicating with it to the year 2022 or 2024. So we'll be hearing more about that when we get to the space report. Okay, the very first person who signed in with a question was Rich at 2EL. Go right ahead with your question, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and everybody on the TechNet. And 2EO, Dick, got a question which is more of an opinion on your part. You could be right, you could be wrong. It's conjecture. But right now, you know, I live in Massapequa Park. I'm on the border of Nassau and Suffolk County. And Right now I'm using a Comet vertical. It's a 2 meter 440 1.2 vertical that I'm using on 2 and 440 alone. I like using a repeater that not only has a 440 input and output, but it's got auxiliary inputs on 10 meters, 220 as well as 440, and 1.2. And I use this repeater on 2 and 440. I'm thinking of going switching over to a disco, which has a wide band coverage but no gain, and actually a slight bit of loss. You might explain to people what a discone is, and do you think, this is where it's conjecture on your part. From where I am, do you think I'd make it to Queens with about 40 watts on a discone? I'm full quieting into most repeaters. The one that I use in, on 440, I have a little bit of noise on me and coming back the same way. Do you think a discone would be a showstopper, to use your language? Back to Ned and Julio.
Yeah, I'm going to be passing this question out over to the rest of the people listening for their comments. I'm going to start off with a couple of comments of my own. The discone antenna, if you've ever seen one, in the very early days, it literally consisted of a sheet metal cone for the bottom half of the antenna. Right at the center peak of that cone, at the apex of the cone, was a small hole where the coax cable came through. The center conductor came through that hole and connected to a radiator. The shield went to the actual cone itself, and the radiator, you would think it would be a vertical piece of wire. It was really a something that looked like a 78 RPM record, if you know what I mean, made out of sheet metal that was connected to the center conductor. The good news about a disc cone is that it has a lot of bandwidth to it. A properly made disc cone might have moderate performance at 28 megs, good performance at 50 megs, rather good performance on 2 meters through 1,000 or 1,500. That's the good news. And it's got a bunch of wiggles in the standing wave ratio. As a receiving antenna into a scanner receiver, people are very happy with that antenna. To transmit with it, because of the law of reciprocity, it should transmit equally as well. Well, many a discone, depending on how well it's built, whatever, will have bumps and grinds of its VisWall where it will, at certain frequencies, it will hit a 3-to-1 or a 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Some transmitters are unhappy with that amount of a standing wave ratio. So, and the biggest variable for you, the biggest variable for you to get from Massapequa to Queens is terrain. If your particular property is near the water in Massapequa and you're down at 10 feet above sea level and your antenna is only on the chimney of the house, getting to Queens with a nice strong signal is a little bit questionable. How high is the repeater in Queens? And is it on the Queens-Nassau border? Is it on the Queens-Brooklyn border? Lots of variables there. Altitude makes a lot of difference. The exact gain of the antenna is sometimes secondary. Altitude makes a lot of difference. If a guy is able to mount an antenna high enough, and if it's a radiole antenna made out of coat hanger wire, and it's got a standing wave ratio under 3-to-1, so to speak, fed with a piece of RG58 cable, if it's high enough in the air, it will talk from western Suffolk County all the way into Manhattan, if you're talking to a good repeater, if you've got enough altitude. And you can take the most expensive antenna in the world with a zillion dB of gain, but you mount it 10 feet above the ground on pieces of low-level ground in eastern Nassau County, where James Hill is to the west of you, and you got to go through that hill to get to Queens, you might not make it. So there's a lot of variables involved. Those are some of my opinions on this one. So when it comes to his Comet antenna, the possibility of adding a discone, to add other antennas. Antennas, with the friendships you've got, with the friendships you've got, various people will from time to time offer you an antenna at rather attractive prices. Antennas are not expensive. They're not very heavy for VHF, UHF antennas. Putting multiple poles up on the house to put up a higher pole alongside of the house, maybe in a tower, maybe even in your crank-up tower. Methods by which you get more antennas and more altitude, always is going to make an improvement. No matter how many antennas you've got in your backyard, you're always going to want more of them. Somebody helped me recently put an antenna on my tower and connected it to a very good-looking piece of cable. And it wasn't until tonight that I finally discovered where that piece of cable, where the other end was. I got about the 30-some-odd cables coming down my tower. Couldn't find the right one. And the right one, you know the way it is. The very last one I looked at the bottom of the pile in a cable tray, hidden from all the other cables. I'm counting the number of cables going into the tray and the number coming out. I said, hey, that number ain't right. There's one missing. I started digging around and found the guy. You never have enough antennas, Rich. Now, anyone else with any suggestions for Rich on altitude, antennas, bandwidth, 2 meters, 220? He's trying to cover all the VHF frequencies you can tell. 1.2 gigs, 220, 10 meters, 440, and 2 meters. And he's going to want 6 meters eventually. So any suggestions you guys got, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB with a comment.
John recognized. Anyone else?
S2N comment.
All recognized. We got John and Paul. Anyone else?
K2QIQ.
And Glenn. Oh, boy. Hey, Rich, you got friends. John first. Go ahead, John. And Eric recognized. John first. Go ahead.
EC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I have a nice disc call. It's a Radio Shack. Nice stainless steel. Beautiful job. I can, at 30 watts, I can hit Plainview, I can hit the North Shore, 2 meters at 440, and also Manhattan does pretty well. So Rich might be able to do it. Back to you, Dick. EC2WGB.
Of the locations you just discussed, John, I think Glen Oaks is the furthest one. The good news is that you're on the side of Todd Hill, Toad Hill, one of the highest things that's on the island of Staten Island, Richmond County, and that gives you an advantage. But I think the greatest distance of all the ones you mentioned was Glen Oaks. I am guessing Glen Oaks is 25 or so miles from you. Is that approximately the number, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, that's pretty close. 25, 30 miles. Yeah. And it transmits very well, receives very well.
Very fine, John. So there's a testimony in favor of Disco. Alrighty. Let's see what Paul's got to say. WS2N. You're out there almost in central Suffolk County, Monconkoma. And so you got some mileage to make up when it comes to getting to some of your favorite repeaters. Let's see how you're doing, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I know. I'm using the 10-element beam Cushcraft with a rotator, so I do Connecticut, no problem. Good portion of Connecticut. Worked hard for it. No problem, of course, with Glen Oaks and, of course, Selman. And I just want to let Rich know that he's making it to me. I heard him pretty good on the input. Not Deadpool quieting, but pretty close. Could be propagation tonight, but from last week we could park to here. My guess is he probably can make the Selman repeater right now. Back to you there, Rich. K2RIWWS.
Okay, good piece of information. And since I've been at your QTH, I know that you live in a very nice flat area of Ronkonkoma, where you're not in the valley, you're not on the top of the hill, so you're in what I would call average land, was the feeling I had. I didn't feel like I was going uphill as I went to your QTH. And when I visited Paul, because he was in the backyard, and no one was in the house to hear the doorbell ringing or the door being knocked on. I walked around in his backyard and whistled his call letters to get his attention. There's another whole story there. Okay, Glenn, what's your recommendation? What have you used? I know that when you were in Florida, you used some pretty wild antennas that had to survive some tremendous amount of lightning. And so, since you are also in Massapequa, probably for all we know, you're not very many miles from Rich. You probably got some good suggestions. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. Good evening, Rich, and everyone on the net. Yeah, I just wanted to kind of point out, this is a disco. It's mounted at about 30 feet, and using about 10 watts of power. So I figured I'd just throw it in there as a demonstration. K2RI7, T2QIQ. And you're giving me about an S6 signal on the input, Rich. Okay, here we go, Glenn. So, once again, you probably said it, but I missed it. Wait, roughly how many feet above the ground is your disc cone that you're using right now, Glenn? Go ahead. Just about 30 feet, Dick. And you've got that mounted to the chimney of the house, or it's on its own separate pole, Glenn? Go ahead. It's mounted kind of like on a pole with some other antennas. It's kind of like I've got some Yagis and some other things up there, and I kind of have it sitting up on top. But since Hurricane Sandy, I never really raised the altitude of my antennas again, so maybe 35 feet tops, but I'd say 30 to 35, which could be easily achieved on a, you know, on a ranch house or a cape with you know, a small mast and a tripod or a chimney mount. And the antennas aren't that heavy. Match-wise, not that bad, but if that's a concern, you could use a couple of antenna switches and some antenna tuners and basically, you know, trim it up for the different bands that you want. But so far, I can use it on 1.2 without a tuner, near on 2 and 70 centimeters, so that's pretty much all I use this for. KC2QIQ.
Good sign, Glenn. So I'm hearing almost all positive information about a disc cone. See what Eric's got to say. Here's a man who uses really, really serious antennas. His favorite antenna is only 330 feet in the air. His broadcast antenna on Channel 21. Well, that's the small one. But what he's got in New York City on Empire State Building, I'm guessing that's around 1,350 feet in the air. I bet that gets out. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Eric, look at your screen.
Roger, Dodger. Okay. We'll be doing that. And any other information you want to give us about an antenna, Eric?
Not really. I just wanted to get your attention. That's all. No, there's a lot of different ways to go. One guy say this way of doing it, not the next guy. What can I say?
Very fine, Rich. Let me know, Eric. Okay, so let's see. I think we've gone through the list of everyone who signed it who had some further information for, had some further information for Rich. If we missed you by mistake, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, looks like all is well. Rich, N2EO, as I see it, you can't go wrong with a disc cone. It's not the most ideal antenna, but it's the one with the greatest amount of bandwidth. Reasonable VISWAR, and it's not going to be your last antenna. Guarantee 6 months from now you're going to buy another one, or someone's going to supply you another one. No matter how many antennas you got as a serious ham radio operator, it's never enough. The guy who owns a sailboat is never big enough. The guy who's on ham radio, he never has enough antennas. So you're not going to go wrong with that one, but you know you're going to be adding others to it. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, I'd like to have what John said. He's using the Radio Shack. Now, the Radio Shack does not have a vertical radiator above the horizontal, if you put it, 78 RPM record. The ICOM makes a disc going, and it does. I'm wondering if that would be better for 10 meters, and I wonder which one Glenn has, if it's the Radio Shack or the ICOM. And I'm north of Sunrise Highway. I really don't know the lay of the land here because I spent up to now, I hope it changes, but up to now I spent more time in the hospital than at home. But now I'm starting to learn the roads around here. But I'm just a little bit north of Sunrise Highway, told to buy a house on this side because of flooding. And I had no problem during Hurricane Sandy. Let me turn it back to you. Turn it over to Glenn, and I'd like to know which one he has. By the way, Glenn is full scale on the input. Over to you, Dick, and then go on to the next person, and to Leo.
Dick, my Radio Shack has a vertical element that comes out of the ground plane radials.
Yeah, I think some of them do. And you're about S7 or S8 at my house right now, Rich. And by the way, that bottom cone, which I described as a piece of sheet metal in the early days, is now a whole bunch of individual wires, call them ground plane radials, that are slanted down at a 45 or a 50 degree angle. And as long as there's enough of them and they're close enough together, the RF can't tell the difference as to whether or not it's a solid sheet of metal or individual wires, if you know what I mean. So which one of the disc cones are you using, Glenn? That's what Rich would like to know. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. This disc cone does have a vertical whip right at the center, and this is also a MFJ was the manufacturer.
Okay, and roughly how many dollars was MFJ asking for that antenna at the year that you bought it, Glenn?
It's around $50, Dick, if I remember, on eBay.
Okay, so good luck with that project, Rich. Guarantee you'll be using it and other antennas as time goes on. I'm going to go on to the next guy now, Tom. Kilo Delta 2 Echo Sierra Whiskey. What would you like to discuss tonight? We'll discuss anything except antennas, Tom. That was a joke. You got it, Tom. K2RIW.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is an antenna question. Kind of due to HF, just getting on the HF band. Put up the Windham antenna about 133 foot total, about 20 foot wide. Seems to be doing some decent with this setup, so I'm trying to see how I can get that better than just going high.
Yeah, when you come back, I'm going to be curious as to whether or not you're using one of the new Baofengs or Ruxon radios. Your audio is very, very low, so you better eat the mic, shout into the mic, and talk a little bit louder. So your Windham antenna, 133 feet long, 20 feet off the ground. Wire antennas, there's a zillion ways of feeding wires. The so-called Lou Varney antenna, the G5RV, ordinary center-fed dipole, the Windham, which in some embodiments is an off-center-fed dipole, and various guys are slowly getting the idea that when you end-feed the dipole, when you feed the outer end of a solid piece of wire with no longer a center insulator, and you make that piece of wire electronically a half wavelength long, which really means, in the case of 80 meters, it would really be 132 feet long, or you can shorten it by adding loading coils and zigzagging and dropping the ends and loading capacitors and whatever. You could, if you want to, make an 80-meter dipole 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. And if you smart enough electronically, you'll get 95% of the performance out of that compared to the full-size antenna. So what I'm getting at, though, is the guys who put up a vertical piece of wire that is electronically and usually physically a half wavelength long and feed the bottom end of it with reference to a spike in the ground, particularly at a field day site. Let me drop. Now, those guys tend to be extremely happy with the performance. The only thing that's a little bit hokey is that when you feed the outer end of a dipole, you're not feeding a 70 ohm antenna anymore. You're feeding a 1500 ohm antenna. So it requires an impedance matching device. The impedance matching device for one particular band is a single inductor and a single capacitor, as a so-called L network. And so your coax cable goes into one end of that thing, the center tap between the two goes to the antenna, and it steps up the impedance from 50 ohms to the 1500 that you need. And the design of that L network can easily be gotten by way of the so-called Berkeley. You go to you Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and out comes a beautiful program by the Berkeley people in California. You tell them what impedance you got from the antenna, what impedance is your transmission line or transmitter, and what frequency you're operating at, and you press go, and in 1 second it gives you 16 possible solutions, an inductor and capacitor, as a L network, a T network, a pi network, an LT, an LPi, and so on. Choose the one that you like of the 16. So don't be afraid of impedance matching step up between 50 ohms of your transmitter and the 1500 ohms from the outside of an antenna. Altitude helps a lot. HF is very nice in that you don't absolutely positively have to have super high altitude. You don't absolutely positively have to clear the trees. On 80 meters, your trees are reasonably transparent. You go up to 440 megacycles. Let me drop. On 440 megacycles, your trees are going to suck up that signal and turn it into heat. And if your antenna is lower than those trees and there's leaves on those trees in the summertime and there's water on those because it just rained, you'd be amazed how much your signal gets sucked up. Of all the guys I used to talk to on 432, because I had calibrated my receiver system with a signal generator, and I knew how much automatic gain control voltage out of that receiver I got into my Hewlett Packard, my Heath kit, V7A vacuum 2 voltmeter. That was connected to the automatic gain control wire of the receiver. And so I calibrated microvolts of input to AGC voltage output, AVC voltage of output. So everybody I talked to on 432, and that was 440 guys. Each week somebody would ask me, hey Dick, how many microvolts are you getting from me today? I just raised my antenna another 10 feet. I added two more elements to the Yagi or whatever. Last week you were running 32 microvolts, this week you're running 45 microvolts. That's X number of dB of improvement. Those are the questions people would ask me. But the guys whose antennas cleared the trees, summer, winter, spring, fall, they stayed almost the same. The guy whose antenna was lower than his tree level, in the summertime after a rain, his signal was 20, 25 dB weaker than it would be in the wintertime when there was no leaves on the trees. So on 440, clearing the trees is important. On 80 meters, you can almost ignore the trees. Somewhere around 10 meters is where the changeover starts taking place. So altitude, putting up more wire, making some of the wires east-west, some of them north-south, some of them vertically polarized, some of them horizontally polarized, a switching network to go between the two. No matter how many antennas you've got in your backyard, Tom, it's never enough. And stop worrying about the neighbors. Your non-technical neighbors do not see wire. You can
repeat your timeout.
You can ask each one of the people who visit you, what's the color of the shingles on my house? You'll see that 95% of your visiting friends don't know the answer to that. They don't look up in the air. And even if they do look up in the air, they don't see wire. So you can't put up enough wires. When you start putting up towers and Yagis and whatever, they're going to start noticing that. So I don't know if I've really addressed what you're sort of asking, Tom. And no matter what antenna you use, you wish you would be heard a little bit louder. It'd be nice to have a whole afterburner of a kilowatt during the pileups. You'd like to be able to open the band. The guys who have got a full rotatable five-element Yagi on 80 meters, and there is one of those guys in Japan, he loans the band to us, if you know what I mean. He's the first guy on and the last guy off when the band closes up, so to speak. So you can never have enough antenna, and if you're willing to make the investment, my goodness, can you get performance out of a whole lot of aluminum in the air if you know how to do it. And by talking to the people who come to this net, there's a good chance you'll find out how to do it if you want to make an investment in that area, Tom. KD2, Echo Sierra Whiskey, K2RIW.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, you definitely answered a lot of the questions I had. Just so you know, it is one of the old-fashioned radios that I'm on. So thank you again. KD2, ESWF.
Okay, I did hear you say it was a Bofang. As an experiment, Tom, your audio is a good 10 to 15 decibels lower than my audio is right now. I'm listening with earphones to my audio versus yours. Just for the heck of it, as an experiment, put your mouth up right to that microphone, the little hole in the upper left-hand corner, and talk good and loud. Let me see whether or not you're able to bring that radio up to a higher amount of audio. Give me a quick transmission on that one, Tom. KD2 ESW, K2RIW, the TechNet.
All right, this is Tom, KD2 ESW. I'm hoping this is a little bit louder for you.
You doubled your volume. So you went from 10 dB low to 7 dB low. You definitely came up. Just for the heck of it, talk louder. Almost shout into that mic. Let's hear what it sounds like. Over to you, Tom.
I think this is Tom, KD2 ESW, hoping this is a little bit louder.
Okay, that's an improvement. You could go louder yet. One last try. Really shout into that mic. Let's see what you... Make believe you're talking to somebody 15 feet away, and you're talking real loud to make sure he hears you. And you're going to be a half inch away from that mic. Give it a try.
This is KV2 ESW coming in, hopefully clearance.
You came up, but you can go more. The experiment is telling me that when you get as close to the mic as you can and shout into it, you do not overmodulate. That rig needs a lot more audio. What some people have done is to drill a bigger hole where the audio, where the microphone is located. Some of them found a piece of felt or something in there that they removed. There's all kinds of ways of increasing the audio, but you do need a hell of a lot more audio. And the experiments we just ran, you made a lot of improvement. Make sure you always use the rig that way until you make some further modifications, Tom. That particular rig gives you a lot of performance for the money. But that low audio, it's not your fault, it's not their fault. The crazy Federal Communications Commission has come out with this new narrowband mandate. Some foolish person thinks that if we make everybody use narrow FM, super narrow FM on their commercial transmitters, that now you'll have twice as many people you can squeeze into the same number of megacycles. On paper, that sounds good. Because what it does to the real amplitude sidebands of the signal that you're modulating, you're losing a lot faster than you're gaining. It's going to take them a lot of years to discover that this was the biggest mistake they've made in a long time. That's an opinion.
Okay. He should make sure he's in wideband mode also.
Yeah, when you go to the separate menus in there is something called narrow and wide, and make sure you're in wide. However, what it calls wide is what used to be called super narrow. What it calls narrow is doubly narrow. Make sure you're in the wideband mode on its menu. And the menus in there are a little bit hokey. It's a little bit hard to program that thing, but once you find out how, it's worth making the investment. Good luck with that one, Tom. And Tom, as you do further investigation as to what antenna you're going to build next, how much more wire you're going to put in the air, what modifications you make to your Malfang, any of those pieces of information, come back and tell us what you discovered. We'd like to hear from you. Okay, Mike, K1MJM, Mike number two. The Mike, one of those guys with these beautiful websites that we can go to. Go right ahead, Mike. K1MJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Roger, Dick, this is K1MJM. By the way, you mentioned the Berkeley website before. There's a link to that on my website about two-thirds of the way down the page. Okay, I have a question for you. I'm a volunteer at the Rolnick Observatory in Westport, and I want to build a radio telescope for them. I have a 35 dB gain LNA, this is going to be a hydrogen line, by the way, a 1400 megahertz bandpass filter, and a 20 dB gain 45 element loop Yagi for your recommendation. By the way, to drop it.
Yeah, I'm hearing you on the input, Mike, and I think we're getting some interference tonight, but since I'm hearing you on the input, I'll be able to repeat your question. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm hearing you beautifully, but you're not coming through the machine right now because of some interference. So go ahead and read your question, and I'll repeat it on the air.
Roger that. Okay. Along with the things I just said above, feedback from the computer, and I ended up finding Linear Technologies RF logarithmic detectors. Let me let it drop. Okay, I found an LP5504 800 megahertz, 2.7 gigahertz, minus 80 dB to 2 dBm to 2 dBm crystal logarithmic detector. Puts out a DC voltage. I'm thinking about using that instead of that $3,000 black box that I can't afford. What do you think about that, Dick?
Okay, you got a beauty of a question there. Okay, so to bring everyone up to speed of what Mike's doing, he's involved with a local astronomy group, and they're going to be getting serious about radio astronomy. And one of the very first major frequencies that was ever used in radio astronomy is a so-called hydrogen line at 1420 megahertz. 14, 20, and a whole lot of decimal places. It's a very exact frequency with individual hydrogen atoms are floating around in space. And there's more hydrogen in this universe than there is anything else. So it's one of the first things you want to look for. So as those individual hydrogen atoms become excited, which really means that they're electrons that go from the first ring, the first orbital distance away from their nucleus up to the next orbital, so a cosmic ray or something comes along, a burst of light or whatever, excites that particular free-floating hydrogen atom. As it drops back down from the second orbital to the first orbital, it gives off an extremely exact amount of energy on exactly the frequency 1420 and a bunch of decimal places. So looking for 1420 megacycle, broadband noise, so to speak, in space, with a high gain antenna, as you aim that antenna, and you know the antenna pattern, you make a picture. You might be waving the antenna by way of the Earth rotation or your azimuth elevation motors. You're waving a particular nebula, an object in space, where a star exploded one time. Let me drop. And as you pick up the energy from that star, because it's got a whole lot of locally excited hydrogen atoms because of what took place during that nova, supernova, or whatever, or the collision of two stars, or a star and a planet, or a black hole and a white dwarf, or a pair of white dwarfs, or neutron stars. There's all kinds of ways that Mother Nature can emit tremendous amounts of energy during certain events. And the local hydrogen cloud is going to be excited by that. You aim your antenna at it, and there's energy there. That's the good news. And with a high-gain antenna, your 45-element Loop Yagi, tuned to 1420 megacycles, a very good beginning antenna. And the day may come when you decide that because you and the group of guys working with you are so crafty, that once you decide the 20 dB gain, I think it is 45 element loop Yagi at 1420 megacycles, maybe that was manufactured by Earth Energy, Directive Systems. One of the guys in Maine, in Lebanon, Maine, a good buddy of mine, Dave Olean, K1WHS, runs this beautiful antenna company called Directive Systems. And once you decide that, hey, that's a good design, you test it out and you like it, you either gather some more money and buy more of them, or you decide that, hey, these are simple pieces of aluminum. I could homebrew this in. You and your buddies might decide to make a group project where you decide to homebrew that particular antenna. And so you make an array of them, two of them at first, and then four of them, and then eventually 16 of them, and so on. As you double the number of antennas, the antenna pattern becomes sharper, the gain goes up 3 dB every time you double the number of antennas. So when it comes to a project, it's going to have some teeth to it. When it comes to a project, it's going to have some legs to it. It's going to have some life. Radio astronomy is a beautiful one. So the antenna is one of the most important portions of it. The second most important portion of a good radio telescope is a low noise front end, and you've got that. You've got a low noise amplifier with lots of dB of gain at 1420 megacycles, so now you're amplifying that signal before it gets mixed with the noise of your feed line insertion loss and the rest of the amplification of your receiver system. That's the second most important thing. The third most important thing is the so-called radiometer. Now, what is a radiometer? It's a very different kind of detector. Whether or not your particular radiometer should be linear or logarithmic, that's a minor detail. The real thing about a radiometer is that it has a whole lot of RF bandwidth or IF bandwidth. In other words, the pre-detection bandwidth is going to be as broad as you can make it. Many a good radio telescope, the pre-detection bandwidth is 4 megacycles, 40 megacycles, 400 megacycles, sometimes 4 gigahertz. Of course, with 1420 centers, you're not going to be doing that. If you're doing it at 60 gigs, to make it 4 gigs wide for the RFI bandwidth would make a lot of sense. At 1400 megs, you're probably not going to go much beyond 10 megahertz. As you make the bandwidth in front of the detector as wide as you can get, and you make the bandwidth amp the detector, the so-called video bandwidth, as narrow as you can get. That's called the pre-detection, post-detection bandwidth ratio. That's a fancy way of saying integration factor. Let me make a ridiculous example out of this. Let's assume now that I had a 10 megacycle bandwidth in front of the detector. I made sure that my RF bandwidth, and I converted down to an IF strip, and the IF strip is 10 megacycles wide. And now, after detection, I make the video bandwidth 10 hertz wide. In other words, a tenth of a second of response time of the video bandwidth. That's going into the strip shot recorder, or whatever the equivalent that records your intent. The example I gave, 10 megacycles of bandwidth in front of the detector, 10 hertz of bandwidth after the detector, that's a 1,000,000-to-1 ratio. Your integration factor is 1,000,000,000-to-1. That increases your sensitivity by something close to 60 decibels. In other words, the real signal you're listening to, the noise coming out of those free electrons, out of that nebula that you're aimed at this time. And your first measurement, by the way, is going to look at the sun, because the sun gives you a nice big honking, big, loud signal on the 1420 megacycle line, and as you allow the sun to sweep through your antenna, you're really tracing your antenna pattern and using the universe as an antenna range, if you know what I mean. But what I'm getting at is that because you've got such a big pre-detection, post-detection bandwidth ratio, and as long as you're using something called the Dickey switch, in other words, the gain of your receiver is going to be calibrated at the switching rate. You're going to be switching back and forth between the antenna and a dummy load at 400 times per second, maybe. That might be your particular Dickey switching rate, in which case you're recalibrating the gain of your receiver 400 times per second. No matter how fast the transistors change in gain because they're heating up, no matter how fast your power supply goes up and down, compared to 400 cycles and a whole lot of integrating, that all washes out, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So when you do that correctly, when you do this radiometry technique, a very large pre-detection bandwidth, post-detection bandwidth, which doesn't have to be an expensive piece of hardware, you can homebrew that. But now that you know the words to look for, and you know how to start doing it, once you've got the right kind of a ratio of front detection, and pre-detection, and post-detection bandwidth ratio, and once you've got a receiver that's stable enough in gain, because you're Dickey switching it, which means you're calibrating 400 times per second, so to speak. Once you've got that combination, the noise that you're listening to coming out of that nebula could be 20 decibels weaker than the noise of your own low noise front end. In other words, the signal is 20 dB below the noise. The signal you're looking for can be 20 dB below the noise because you've got a big enough ratio. You will see that beautiful curve on the strip chart as that nebula peeps in front of your antenna. So radiometry, the integration factor, to integrate out the noise, to really look at the difference of the signal when the antenna is looking at cold sky versus the signal when you're looking at that nebula, to look at that ratio and plot it correctly, that's where radio astronomy really shines. There's a whole class of electronic countermeasures techniques. Let me drop. There's a whole system of countermeasures and techniques that have been used in electronic warfare, which is called LEES search, low energy emitter search, LEES, which really is a kind of radiometry. When you use these techniques correctly, and the guys who run a really high class antenna range, where they want to really look deep down into the side lobes and back lobes of an antenna, they also need radiometry, because the choices are to either run a kilowatt transmitter or use radiometry at the receiver. The first time you hear all this jazz, I know it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Maybe you're already familiar with some of these. And if you do read a couple of the really good classic books I know about, the two books I know of are entitled Radio Astronomy. One of them is by Krauss, and one of them is by Steinberg and Lecue, a French guy, but it's translated into English. Those two books, classic books on radio astronomy, you read those and you're going to say, wow, what have these guys been doing, which is so different than the kind of communication we do. You and I, under ordinary ham radio circumstances, we want to pass a voice back and forth, or we want to pass Morse code signals back and forth. the radio telescope people, they do something very different with their radiometry. And they've got 20 or 30 decibels of increased sensitivity over us by these techniques. I wonder if some of this makes some sense, Mike, and you're allowed to ask this question as many times as possible because there's a lot to it. K1MJM, make sure you wait for the four beeps, K2RIW and the TechNet. Go ahead, Mike.
Roger, that's it. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I've looked for those books. I have not had luck finding them. Libraries don't really carry too many books anymore. They're ones around here anyway. I'll keep looking for them. I've done some online searching. To get me started, I was going to use that logarithmic detector just to get our feet a little bit wet. And like I said, I have the other hardware already in my possession, and I just wanted to jump in and get started. And I was just going to try that crystal detector, which converts RF to voltage, DC voltage. That was really get me started. Zach Olszewski, K1MJM.
Yeah, an awful lot of the radio telescopes use what's called a square law detector. In other words, they put just the right amount of signal strength gain in front of the crystal detector that is running in the square law region. They get extra sensitivity out of doing that. Logarithmic detector, the advantage it has is a very large amount of dynamic range. If once in a while you're going to be looking at a very weak nebula, and then an hour later the sun is going to wave across your antenna, and the sun is, let me pick a number, 65 decibels louder than the nebula you want to look at, any ordinary square law or linear detector would saturate up the kazoo under that circumstance. A logarithmic detector would not. A good logarithmic detector could have as much as 100 decibels of dynamic range without saturating. That's the good news. The bad news is down at the toe of the response of a logarithmic detector. It is not as sensitive in the radio astronomy radiometry technique as a so-called square law detector, which has the minimum of dynamic range. So you've got a trade-off here. When you go for the maximum sensitivity of a radio telescope and you're using a square law detector, you literally have the minimum of dynamic range. If you set it up for looking at weak signals, you're only good at looking at weak signals, and strong signals will saturate you. So the fact that your detector is logarithmic is, in my opinion, a mixed blessing if it doesn't have the right pre-detection, post-detection bandwidth ratio. If it is a video log, yes, it could do it. If it's an RF log, I'm worried, because RF logs, to have enough pre-detection bandwidth to them so that you're getting a big enough integration factor. By the way, the integration factor, call it the smoothing effect. If you have a great big integration factor, the curve you get out of your radio telescope is a beautiful, smooth curve that follows the exact antenna pattern, if you know what, repeater.
Time out.
When you get a big integration factor, you get a nice, smooth curve that follows your antenna pattern, and you know exactly where the peak of the curve is and where the nebula is located. If you don't have a big enough ratio, you could say the needle dances around, or the strip chart recorder dances around. You've got a whole lot of peaks and valleys and spikes with a curve buried in it, and it becomes a lot more difficult to see when the antenna is aimed at the source. So the integration factor is where the rubber meets the road when it comes to proper operation of a radiometer-type radio telescope. So if you've already got the logarithmic detector, go ahead and use it. But it might not be the ultimate way of doing it, but I might be wrong on this one. When it comes to Steinberg and LeCue and radio astronomy by Krauss, consider also the used book sources. There's a whole bunch of websites where that particular organization collects used classic books. And so, although you may not find a brand new one, Amazon or any of these other eBay and so on, consider some of the Libra, I think is the name of one of those websites, where there are used books, and there's a chance you're going to find it there. There's this beautiful, let me drop. I wish they didn't get moved. There was this beautiful used bookstore in Huntington. I'm having trouble thinking the name of them. They went out of business 20 years ago, and they sold used engineering books. Oh, boy. Every time I walked in there, I knew I was going to spend some money before I could get back out of there. Boy, did they have some really good books. So consider used books. And who cares if somebody has written some notes in the page, and a couple of the pages are folded in a funny ways, and the front cover is not pretty looking. You're looking for information. You're not looking for beauty. Over to you, Mike. K1MJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, that's a lot of information. Very good.